Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 79, where Ralph, Tom, Fritjof, and Jared are discussing Jane Addams's 1894 speech, A Modern Lear, about her reflections of the Pullman Railroad strike. If you missed part one, you can access it on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. So we concluded part one, talking a little bit about pragmatism itself, and also some literary tools that we could use to better express what's going on in what is a very, very complex, very dynamic, very volatile situation. I want to expand the aperture a little bit about the Pullman strike itself, because on the one hand, Jane Addams is talking about the labor relations from the duality of the labor and the management perspectives. But the Pullman strike itself had two significant other parties that we ought to account for if we start thinking about how these labor relations situations play out in contemporary times. And that's government and the public. Now, in the case of the Pullman strike, ultimately, as it expanded, and as we mentioned before in part one, when it started to influence or it became apparent that mail service was becoming impacted, well, government became a very significant third party into this. And they bulldozed their way in. You had the deployment of soldiers. You had all sorts of very, very strong actions taken to try to bring the strike to the end. But you also had public opinion. And public opinion certainly matters in any labor situation, because when you have labor strife, you have the potential for disruption of goods, disruption of services. The public's ability or dependence upon those goods and services could very well be a factor in whether or not a strike is prolonged or a lockout is prolonged or what have you. Certainly, the public has been a big player when it came to work stoppages in professional sports. So what we want to do is we want to kind of think beyond just the labor management as the two parties and think about, that these sorts of situations are very multidimensional. And so our understanding about, how do you go from a bipolar negotiation to a multipolar negotiation. I'm starting to think, everything that we talked about, pragmatism in the part one, is even more attractive. What do y'all think?
Well, I know that Fritjof's going to chime in on pragmatism, because he and I are both very, very focused on pragmatism, which is one of the reasons that these conversations are so much fun. I think, Tom, it's really important to talk about the multidimensional nature. And Addams mentions that throughout the labor struggle, Pullman and the Pullman Company were focusing on individual virtues, individual behavior. And Tom really nailed it when he said it was more than that, but that's the only way they were able to see it. And it's also an indication, which I think Jared mentioned earlier, was this idea of when you take employment and relations between employer and you scale them up massively in the Industrial Revolution, it changes things. And Tom, you just gave a great example of how the government has interest now that it never used to have if you were just working on a farm, or it was you're in one form of employment and it's a small business. And it might seem paradoxical, but it's not really anymore. And we shouldn't be surprised that the public has an interest, and I'm not talking about just because they don't get their mail. I mean, that's important, but this idea that many times if you don't win the public over to your side and maintain a connection with the wider society, you're lost, and then it really just does an individual thing, and you're going to struggle to get your idea across. One, you were talking about examples where the public gets involved, and one occurs to me is there was a pretty big strike in the United States with the United Parcel Service, and from day one, the workers had the sympathy of the public, even though they weren't getting their things, because they identified with the man or the woman that brings them their package and not with the corporate interests. And so there's a great example where from day one, the company was not, from a public relations point of view, in a position of strength. And before I turn it over, I want to say one more thing. You're also illustrating that the point that Adams makes is that, look, if you could have great knowledge about how things work today, but things change. And the knowledge that you enter into these things with, or your experience of what it was like to work, you know, 10 years ago, isn't sufficient. As pragmatism teaches, you must keep learning. You must figure out what works and what doesn't work and be willing to discard things that don't work. And so she makes a big statement in favor of this understanding that it's not about saying, well, I have enough knowledge or I have the experience. It's understanding how that evolves over time.
So there's an interesting quote by Jane Addams about this, what Ralph just talked about. The president of the Pullman Company thought out within his own mind a beautiful town. He had the power with which to build this town, but he did not appeal to nor obtain the consent of the men who were living in it. The most unambitious reform, recognizing the necessity for this consent, makes for slow but sane and strenuous progress, while the most ambitious of social plans and experiments, ignoring this, is prone to the failure of the model town of Pullman. And kind of like arguing against kind of like designing just as a kind of like a mental exercise, that you can think up this beautiful town and then you have the power even to do it, but that it's really important to involve the people that you're doing it for and that you're doing it with, and see the relationship there, the need to involve the stakeholders, the whole idea, of course, of stakeholder theory being deeply related to pragmatism. As much as you want to make these ambitious social plans, like, you need the actual experience and you need to actually have the consent and involve the different stakeholders that are required here.
And I think this sort of brings up an example of where you can understand and perhaps empathize with Pullman in terms of, you know, how much energy do participants in one of these major social programs or major activities, how much energy can they devote to going down the sane and strenuous path? It is sometimes, you know, when we think about major problems, major challenges that require significant action, specifically getting into what the government can provide or what the government can do to solve or to break a deadlock or to provide goods and services that people might not get from their companies or safety nets, all that sort of thing. They're all very, very complex. But there's always that temptation, that desire to find the quick, the ideological, the simplistic sounding quick fix, because we need the good and service, or we need something, we need to get it now. Everything that this example speaks to is the need for continuous engagement to understand the situation and to learn, as you had said in part one. But the drive for efficiency, like the drive to get a solution out there, even if it's superficial, could be very, very high, because that's, in essence, what people get, shall we say, noticed for. I don't know if that's
you know. I think it's a good way to say it. It's what they get rewarded for, you know, quickly getting back to work. Yeah. And I think it's powerful, because it's easy for us to say, well, gee, they should have seen this. So not only were they perhaps looking for the quick fix to get back to work, to restore production, to resolve the issue, but... And I think Jared might have hit on this. That's the way they saw the world. And so it's a very powerful from both the point of view of, okay, I don't have to spend too much time thinking because I have this analogy that fits and I'm just going to use it. And humans tend to be like that. And that's one of the things I think Jared, you got to be careful. You know, the map is not the terrain. And so sometimes it doesn't fit, but it's one thing to say that. And it's great advice, but oh, that's not so easy to say. In fact, anybody who's been a parent knows that, because you got this map of how the child operates and what happens, and then he changes, he or she changes, or the next one comes along, you think, okay, I know how this worked, and it doesn't work. And so that's one of those big challenges of parenting, which I think, so I'm not trying to reduce this to a parent-child relationship, even though she does, but it's one of these issues where what you thought, what you understood about the world isn't the way it works anymore.
Maybe an interesting dimension of this is the extent to which Pullman's blindness is a result of his success as a company builder, a town builder, a philanthropist. I'm interested in your guys' thoughts about this. You know, he, just to go back to that particular quote that Fridtjof mentioned, you know, the president of the Pullman Company thought out within his own mind a beautiful town, and he had the power with which to build this town. And he didn't bother about obtaining the consent of the residents and his workers and so on. Perhaps he thought, well, why does he need to do so? Because he is this great man. He's built amazing towns. He was a recognized public figure, I believe. You know, he frequented the nation's capital and probably
went to
all the right parties. So this is the point I'm making. You know, how much was this situation a little bit a result of his own success? And I think in the first part of the episode, in setting out and making the connection to the King Lear play, Ralph made the point that only once Lear lost his power did he then gain insight into what actually was going on.
I think that...
And I wonder if that happened to Pullman. I wonder if after this he changed his view.
That's a great insight, Jared, because nothing blinds you quite as well or quite as much as success. Because you have these things you keep doing. So it was an interesting progression, you know, paying the workers really well, building this town, having this conception. In fact, Adams discusses this very thing, I think, quite well. Around page 6, she says, his conception of goodness for them, so a little condescending, but it's just the way she's expressing it, had been cleanliness, decency of living, and above all, thrift and temperance. So very structural. He had provided them means for all this and had given them opportunities for enjoyment, although nobody could afford to use the theater, but he was ignorant of these other features because they, and perhaps, I don't know, but because they didn't have a lot to do with his success, and yet they had a big impact in this difficulty. What do you think, Fridtjof?
I think that's kind of like, again, the commercial framing or not. What is the king without the, well, what's the leader without the followers? Is it the successful leader, or is it just the way that we like to tell stories that there's these heroes that are like getting the goals or making the money or whatever, and we don't see really all the big part that society, so to say, has invested in, and they have educated the people and they've given him the chance to build his company, etc. So I think it again very much points to kind of like the issue of framing and how we look at things and how we relate the different aspects of the situation into, sort of say, a story that makes it comprehensible to us.
Now, what I wonder is, are we learning the right lessons from this? When we look at, say, the gig economy, we look at some of the other, you know, the newer, more emerging models of work. Back in the day, the company really was, it was basically a stable organization, or it's an attempt at a stable organization, where membership was somewhat permanent. Dependence on the company for one's livelihood was certainly far greater. Nowadays, in a way, would wonder if, the thought process was that we don't really want to be in the position of actually taking care of the workers in the total sense as before, because it is too expensive, it is unnecessary. There are other ways of establishing worker management relationships or relationships between workers and the company that can be a little bit more beneficial, give a little bit more autonomy or whatever. Now, the shifting of who provides for the needs of the people becomes part of this negotiation. Because what the company no longer provides becomes a requirement of somebody else. Is it a government? Is it a civil society? Did we end up in a better place because we have changed the way that labor relations work nowadays? Or have we actually made it more complicated because there isn't somebody that people can really pin a rose on and say, you know, you're responsible for doing this to ensure the welfare of the people?
In fact, it's the opposite, in that some companies are outsourcing that to an algorithm. And how do you have some meaningful interaction with your employer or your manager if your manager is an algorithm? And you see periodically people rebelling. One of the things I think was really important, Tom, you talked about the need is there. The social need is there. So if the company doesn't provide it or doesn't connect to it or doesn't give the workers a way to address it, they're going to find a different way. It could be good, could be bad, but you do see a theme running through many of the interviews that you see with people who are in the gig economy, where they don't have that social connection. And there's actually not even anybody they can talk to. And I read an article recently about gig workers in Spain. And one of the people found it incomprehensible that their actual wages could get reduced. I mean, almost like the Pullman strike, through nothing that they did. And even the economy is not doing well because lots of people sign up to be delivery drivers. You can get this sense of alienation and incomprehension from the workers. And so that does make me think a little bit. So about, maybe too broad to say, are we learning? But it's a great point, because you have to think, what are we learning?
I guess this kind of like, because on the one hand, I guess this relates companies and how we organize companies to society, to government, but also to the role of philanthropy. So to say, like, can you be a bad company and then do good by philanthropy and then it's good? Or is it better to be just a good company that makes philanthropy, so to say, not necessary? And so I really like this quote again from Adams, and it's a bit longer, but I think it really nicely captures what she was talking about back then, but it could also really nicely capture maybe what we're talking about right now. Insofar as philanthropists are cut off from the influence of the zeitgeist, from the code of ethics which rule the body of men, from the great moral life springing from our common experiences, so long as they are good to people rather than with them, they are bound to accomplish a large amount of harm. So like what she's talking about here is that, you know, as the situation changes and there's a bigger change in society, there's a zeitgeist that is also progressing. You know, as the kind of like the water around you changes, you need to be aware of that. And the way to be aware of that is by having experiences, by having common experience, in the sense that we are able to relate to each other and better understand each other. If you are good to people, you're placing them over there. You're putting them at a distance. Well, so to say, being with them allows you to have the different perspective and a better understanding of each other, that I think is really important. And so in that sense, that also with the gig economy, like maybe we need more ways that say people at whichever other company you want to think about, that they have a better understanding of the experiences of, say, the delivery driver and how they go through it. So that they're beyond the user experience. There's also the important topic of employee experience. And how can you have a good user experience if you don't have a good employee experience?
Right. And speaking of the gig economy, one of the things I learned in the gig economy by actually interacting with it, I like to ask whether it's a delivery driver or a Uber driver, but what it's like. When I was in Holland, I got picked up. It was arranged for an Uber ride. And I noticed the man who picked me up was a cab driver. And he had a cab. And yet he was working for Uber. And I said, yeah, but you look like you're a cab driver. And he says, I can't function if I don't do this because it's taken all our work away. And that's when the light bulb came on. Wow, there's more to this. And I didn't feel necessarily guilty, but I understood, wow, there's more to this than just saying, okay, well, they're outsourcing all this work. And here was a guy who was adapting, and I'm not going to comment about whether it was good or bad, but I got some insight into, oh, it has this other effect on cab drivers. It's kind of, you know, I understand it's obvious, but still, maybe not so obvious until you meet somebody and ask them how that's working.
Yeah, that brings up some thoughts in my mind, too, because one of the challenges with, it's not just philanthropy, it's also liability. So I seem to recall, I don't know specifically, that some of the, and I don't know if it was Uber or if it was one of the others, but there were situations in which basically, because you didn't have that same social connection with the company, that, you know, there were issues of drivers who were misbehaving in various ways, using their capacity for being able to commit crimes, or the algorithm was overworking people and all that sort of thing. And it would seem like a very, very quick thing for things to get out of hand before anybody realizes it. You know, so yeah, you're basically providing this space, but then What is the actual liability that comes back to the company for basically controlling what services it's providing? The movement was to try to limit the company's liability, which allows it to essentially provide the services a little bit less expensive, more freely, what have you. But then at some point, there's got to be, at what point or to what extent does this get abused? How does the company, a gig economy type company, have to change its way to become, does it necessarily then have to create its own bureaucracy, which is precisely what it was created to avoid? It's a lot of interesting questions.
It got me thinking. In the first part of the episode, we were talking about how aspects of this case just seem very foreign to us from the perspective of why didn't the parties just sit down and have a bit of a conversation and figure out what was going on? Look, we're limited in what we know about the case from this particular, I guess, account. Jane Adams has told us, she's presented aspects of the case, but I'm not sure to what extent the parties did or did not speak at all. I find it somewhat hard to believe that Pullman didn't know anything about what his workers and residents wanted. But it did kind of then get me thinking of, okay, maybe this still does happen to a lesser extent. And it's not a case I'm very familiar with, but I have heard a little bit about the Amazon workers and their attempts to unionize or join unions. And it did strike me as, okay, maybe there's similarities here about not sitting down and just having conversation about what the workers want.
I think you're right about that. I'm not an expert on Amazon, but you do see worker relations kinds of issues like flexibility in the workplace or on the assembly line of packaging, what kind of breaks are allowed. The descriptions of the workers are pretty bleak. And I do think it's interesting after this, after the recent voting for a union, I think it was interesting that the Bezos and some others had said, we need to rethink, you know, that how we're doing things if we got this kind of reaction out of people. So sort of the anti-Pullman view, but I think very pragmatic in that saying something was driving this desire to unionize, and we need to think more carefully about how we listen. And so that's perhaps a silver lining that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. And you'd like to think, as Jared said, they would sit down and talk and work there with you, but perhaps that's not as common as we'd like to think. And so that's what I thought was really interesting about the Amazon case recently was the statements made in the press that we need to rethink how we do this. We need to pay people more. Wow, that's an interesting way to learn from this kind of a situation.
I have to think a bit of the paper from Human Relations, Tristan Bamford, some social and psychological consequences of the Longwell method of coal getting. I mean, it's a very, very old paper, but it kind of like describes how, you know, the subtitle actually says an examination of the psychological situation and defenses of a work group in relation to the social structure and technological content of the work system. Kind of like relating the social and the technological, you know, that as you change technology, the social also changes. What I found interesting with the Amazon example is kind of like, and I think here is kind of like the boundaries of research and journalism, investigative journalism, are kind of like, you know, we could do both. Like there could be someone doing all the ethnography of working at Amazon, and that could both be maybe an academic article, but also could be a more journalistic article. But like one of the things that I always missed is that people take the that people sort of say volunteer, like they want to work there. People like working there, etc. As okay, therefore it has to be good. I'm like, yeah, but in what situation are these people that they want to work there? If like money was not an issue, would they still want to work there? If not, then what does it tell us? So it is more complex than just going to people and asking them, hey, do you like your job and how do you experience that, etc. But understanding the whole situation, understanding also the wider system and the wider society, how things are set up, why people sort of say end up having to work there and going through that kind of job designs, that kind of day, that kind of experience.
Yeah, and what you're touching on is the dynamics of member commitment. Just the standard three-pronged construct of commitment, where, you know, I like it here, it's better for me to be here than somewhere else, or I owe something to the organization. Just at, you know, at an individual level and at a group level, the commitment changes continuously based on the situation. And it's very easy. I find it easy for, say, management or for leaders to come to an assumption and stick with that assumption about what is the balance of those commitment factors among the workplace. Because on the one hand, when times are really, really good, maybe the typical commitment is, you know, I like it here. Or if you're in an organization where you think that the workers, like if it's a public service organization, you think that an service obligation, like you're expecting loyalty to the mission or the oath of public service as the driver for them being there. You know, if you get fixed on that one picture of what it is that drives people to be working there, then you can definitely get very quickly out of touch with the workforce. You know, again, this reinforces the need to stay engaged because the feelings about individual workers change over time. And you can imagine how in a good economic situation, people, even if, when they like being at an organization, may be thinking, oh, well, okay, where's the grass starting to grow a little bit greener? Maybe I can make a little bit more money over there or something like that. That level of engagement, if you aren't staying engaged, you can have a totally wrong impression of why your workers are staying.
That's a good point. And in fact, she talks about this, the idea of solidarity and the workers noticing how the other workers are treated. And that goes beyond the, well, do I get paid enough and do I like it, which is important. And I think you're hitting on this idea that, well, not only does that change, but some of it's based on how you see other workers being treated. And it's easy to say, well, that person was bad, or we did this individual. But I think a thread that runs throughout organizational science is that people pay attention to how the other people are treated. And whether that's perceived as fair or not, you often don't get a say as the employer or the manager. So it's something to think about. And I thought this was interesting. And I forget, was it Tom that mentioned that she was a philanthropist? Because she specifically singles out philanthropists as potential blind spot holders because of their philanthropy. And so that's even more meaningful to me now that I know she was a philanthropist. To me, it feels like it's an aha moment for her. That you could provide these things for the workers, you could have these good intentions, and yet, as Frithoff and Jared and Tom have all said, that may not be enough because of the social needs of the workers. And the danger of this philanthropy is thinking you know what's in their heads, or you know them with basically just what you imagine or your individual perceptions. I thought that was really interesting, and that's why it kind of jumps off the page at me now, but now I realize that she was a philanthropist.
I'm not sure if she would describe herself as a philanthropist, because I think so, maybe not.
And she may not. I was just thinking Tom mentioned that, so maybe she wouldn't.
She's been attributed as one for sure, because of her work with the settlement houses.
But I think that's kind of like the difference here, that, let's say, philanthropy isn't like you give some money to a good cause and like no one looks at, so to say, where's your money coming from? And there's kind of like an automatic assumption, oh, this is good. You give money to a good cause because it's good, so it's good. And that, like, it's sort of say also the ethics and the ideals and the values, like all of that, as long as it's just in your head, it has to show in practice, is it actually good? It's not a good cause just by labeling it a good cause, but it depends on, like, is it actually good? Can you show actually in practice, is it good?
Right. How does it actually work?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think what you're emphasizing is it's not enough to say, well, I'm an altruist. I care about other people. The real issue is, does it help them? And how does it work? Not what's up in my head about what my intentions are. I think that's what you're getting at, which I think is very important.
So in that sense, like that the Hull House and, like, for example, also the development with pragmatism around education, like it goes deeper. It's not just kind of like the cherry on the cake and, oh, no, I've done something good and I've been a good boy and now I'm finished. No, it's really about, hey, how can we really create progress? And what does progress mean? And how would progress be? And how can we experience that progress? And that's not something that you can just beforehand define and say, okay, now this is good, so let's keep doing that.
Yeah, there's a thread in this about self-awareness, no question about it. And also, continuing on with the Hull House, it wasn't just a matter of co-locating people of different socioeconomic backgrounds. I mean, it was integration. There was efforts to have tutors, or there was all of this activity that was really bringing people of different backgrounds together to do something good for both sides. I understand that she wouldn't necessarily see herself as a philanthropist, but that was definitely a progressive step. It was definitely a good thing that it's the sort of thing that probably deserves a little bit more attention than it's getting right now. Because when we're talking about today's problems, today's challenges, the things that she was trying to do seemed like things that we should take a hard look at, or take a new look at, I guess, would be a better way to put it. You know, what can we take away from what she was doing and try to apply it? Because I think today, that quick solution, the ready-made solution to foist it out there and say, let's go ahead and build stuff, or let's pour money into things, you know, isn't bringing a lot of results.
And she takes it further. She quotes Mazzini, somebody I didn't know about until this podcast and I did the reading. He was an advocate for social reform and unification of Italy. She brings him into it, and I think he makes that precise point, that it's not just your good intentions, your own conscience, but it's also the consent of the men, the consent of the people, obviously men in the generic sense. So the consent of the people, you have to have both if you're going to try to improve society or change things.
What do you take away from reading this? Like, I don't know, there's something in me that kind of like pulls me out of the university and engaging not in just what is, describing what is and doing really descriptive research, but a kind of like this emancipatory nature of her work. It's not just about describing what is describing what should be, but kind of like also what Fuller talks about, like what may be, like that's the point. Let's explore together what may be. And that's just talking for myself, but I feel really inspired by this kind of approach, and sort of saying, still engaging in academic work in that sense, still writing articles, still being out there, but kind of like also there, the proof being in the pudding, like doing good work and still being able to kind of like tell stories to others and also to academics and show what the value of them is beyond the immediate situation that you're in. But I feel that's really inspiring. It pulls me out of university. I don't know if that makes sense.
I think it's a good point. It goes to the heart of what Jared was talking about earlier when he's saying you have to engage with the workers and find out, or your participants in this case, and if you're doing research, you have to engage in and find out what they want, what's important to them. You can come in with certain kinds of beliefs or ideas about what you find. I try not to do that, though, because of the saying, if you go in looking for something, you're going to find it. And it's a challenge. I'm not saying it's easy, but Jared was really advocating earlier this idea of engagement with the people in your organization. I hesitate to say just employees, because it's everybody. It's managers, it's employees, it's your customers, it's those parts that Tom was talking about, the people that very interested third parties that are not directly customers. And I think it gets to the heart of pragmatic aspect. You've got to keep learning. You've got to keep understanding, because things don't change. So I think that is near the essence of the article, is this idea that what worked before isn't going to work in the future, almost guaranteed. And therefore, if your learning stops, or you're not trying to find out more, or you're blind, as she says, like King Lear, that is just not going to go the way you want, because you're going to misunderstand you'll have all these great intentions, but it's philanthropy or trying to build great structures for the workers, and they're going to act ungrateful, because it's not really what they want or what was important to them.
Reading this piece, I was really struck by the sense of despair that Jane Addams had over the situation. I mean, that despair was, yeah, I think it was moving, because I felt like she was distraught over not only the situation, the violence of what happened, but also that this was a wonderful relationship on one level, which had broken up. And I mean, we kind of see that in our lives when relationships come to end and we remember, you know, what was so good about them. I think that's really motivated her to unpack this. Look, you don't see speeches like this every day. I mean, this is quite some speech. It's a well-crafted but very well thought through, I guess, expose for the purposes of unpacking what happened so that we might learn from them and not repeat these mistakes. You know, I wasn't particularly familiar with Jane Addams before this, and you know, reading about her in the process of thinking through the text, I came across one description of her as a public intellectual, and that's quite an interesting phrase. I mean, we use it a lot, but to what degree are people in universities public intellectuals? We're intellectuals, but we're not public. Our intellectualism is not often put to the public use. And this is, you know, Fritjof's point about actually trying to use this insight for a positive outcome in society, a public outcome. To Fritjof's question, what do I take away from this? I take away a kind of a few learnings around how things change and we need to change with those, with the times. You know, the zeitgeist here was changing. She mentions watchwords around brotherhood, sacrifice, subordination of the individual. This was part of a movement and therefore changed how workers thought about their relationship with their employer. And then the other big one was the massive economic disruption that changed their relationship with the employer. So the depression that they were enduring. And so that really changed their view on having a nice looking town and a fancy theatre, which they couldn't attend. And instead they said, well, my employer is also my landlord, and my employer is reducing my wage, but he's not reducing my rent. And so I don't care about your theatre anymore. Just help me to live where I'm living more comfortably. So those are my learnings.
Mine is kind of a energized or renewed appreciation for pragmatism. In some of my recent works, you know, we're talking about, you know, the beginnings of pragmatism here, but I also think it's worth, you know, thinking about or mentioning some of the more recent works that are trying to revive classic pragmatism for the common day. Works like Patricia Shields and her work in the Communities of Inquiry. There's one particular work that I've used recently that I think is, and I'm sure there are probably others like it out there. It was a book by Brendel in 2006, which has been termed applied pragmatism, although he didn't use that term, in which you want to think about, if you find yourself in a situation where you have a complex, you know, unclear problem that needs to be solved, there's four qualities of a good solution, and all of them are drawn from pragmatism. There's the practical aspect, because sometimes we are drawn to try to find that nice, clean, ideological approach that would just sort of put it out there and it'll work good enough, and good enough is good enough. There's the aspect of pluralistic. It's not just those who are the most direct party to the issue, but all perspectives who are involved, like the labor management, government, and public, like I mentioned before, all of those. How do you bring everybody to the table for a multi-party negotiation as opposed to trying to limit participation? The third was participatory. Everybody who is negotiating should be equals, or at least relative equals. And then the last one is provisional, which is to say that no matter what solution you come up with, the way that both Shields and Brendel put it, it's basically the solution to one problematic situation ultimately just creates the next problematic situation. We have to get out of this rather cynical approach of that the solution is out there. We're done. On to the next problem. Okay, never going back. And no, everything that we do, especially in the complex and dynamic world that we're in, everything is provisional. The solution will work for a period of time. And if you have a group of people, what Shields calls a community of inquiry, oriented on what's going on, engaged, then the new problematic situation should not be so much of a surprise that it creates problems. There should be the ability to recognize that the good solution today is starting to fade, and it's time to renegotiate, it's time to engage, it's time to get people together. If we can sort of break the cynicism around the types of problems we face and think about how we can actually use pragmatism, we might be able to move forward a little bit better.
I think for people that are interested in pragmatism, there has been a book, I think now 3 years ago, that's a really good introduction to this, by Philippe Lerino, Pragmatism and Organization Studies. I think there are all the various topics we talked about today are discussed. It's a very nice introduction also because as an experienced manager as well, he has a lot of very nice examples, also because he worked a lot with organizations. Quickly talking about the design aspect here as well, there's kind of like these two, I mean, of course, there's more perspectives, but roughly speaking, there's kind of like these two different paradigms. And one is kind of like more the engineering perspective, where you kind of like you define a problem up front, you derive the requirements, you search for the solution, then you implement the solution. Very linear, yeah, very rational, etc. And the pragmatic perspective, so to say, show and reflect practice, etc., is much more, it's all emergent. And radically speaking, that there is, in that sense, not a teleology, that you have a predefined goal or a predefined plan. Yet how most companies and most governments, so to say, evaluate you is like, you need to have a good plan. You need to have a good idea that we right away already recognize as a good idea. And that's not really how it works. I think in that sense, pragmatism still can really give us interesting and surprising insights, even though it is, in that sense, I guess, quite old. But I think for an introduction, have a look at that book, Philippe Lerino, Pragmatism Organization Studies. And I think also the episode, of course, of our own podcast on Mary Parker Follett and the law of the situation and why the situation is so crucial in pragmatism is a really nice introduction.
Well, I think one of the things I was thinking about when both you, Fritjof and Tom, were talking about the pragmatic aspect to this is that, and it's one of the things I love about pragmatism, is that you heard this expression, oh, so-and-so needs to have more tools in their toolbox, or this is a great tool to add to your toolbox. And pragmatism is sort of anti-toolboxish, or you pull something out of the toolbox and you actually adjust it or decide it doesn't work anymore. So it's not just about finding a better tool. It's about adjusting the tools and how you use them and how you think of the tools. And then I think what Tom said was really, really interesting, and it's so true. This idea that there is no such thing as a permanent solution. It's all provisional. The roots of the problem, tomorrow's problem, is in the solution for today. It doesn't mean it's a bad solution. It's just you got to recognize that eventually your solution doesn't apply anymore.
I guess that's why it's so important with pragmatism to not be dogmatic about pragmatism. And that's also kind of like the challenge. I mean, I'm writing up my PhD thesis now. And one of the things I really find challenging is that in a way, there's almost like there's no theory section. It's all in the story. And you kind of like, as you go along the story and you run into a situation where you feel like, hey, I need a tool, or I need this tool now to better understand the situation. Yeah, then you sort of say you pick it up, and maybe as you work with it, you see like, hey, I need to adjust the tool and okay. But like this would work, and then you sort of say let go again, but there's no toolbox before. These are the 15 tools. Now let's apply them to this case. Now, only once you are in the situation can you see which tools are relevant, and that's of course also why pragmatism is in that sense related to grounded theory, that we don't know beforehand which theory is going to be relevant to this specific situation. So I guess kind of to Ryan round off today's discussion that we had, our nice dialogue. We can just end with the end that Adams wrote herself in her article. That is, by considering the dramatic failure of the liberal employer's plans for its employees, we may possibly be spared useless industrial tragedies in the uncertain future which lies ahead of us. And I think that's also kind of like the lesson here. Like, let's use this to illustrate the future. Let's use this to illustrate the now. But like, even if as an employer you think you're very liberal and you're trying to do good things for your employees, that's not necessarily the way this works out. So let's have this be a good lesson.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberto Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Vili Leidon-Virta, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.